And I'm going to read you a story from the Genesis portion of that book. This is one of the first stories in my adventures with God. My mother read me bedtime stories every night, usually from a volume of Grimm's fairy tales every night. By the time I was three, I learned that there are two kinds of bedtime stories. They're the good ones, in which loyalty is rewarded with love and kingdoms are granted to simple yet honest souls. And there are the bad ones, where the children are eaten, the treasure turns to straw, and the princess is poisoned, sleeps for 1,000 years. With Grimm, I never knew what I was going to get. The ratio of happy to horrible bedtime stories was only detectable in the frequency of my nightmares. Uncertainty is the subtlest form of tyranny. And eventually, I became afraid of the dark. The product of my terror was a monster who took up residence in my bedroom. His name was I, the Monster. That's I, E-Y-E, as in eyeball, because I thought eyeballs were scary, not I, the Freudian I, as in this child needs a psychiatrist. I terrified me, but occasionally he hinted that his task was not to threaten, but to protect. He promised to come out of the toy closet whenever danger was near. One night, I heard a noise on the roof above my bed. I ran down to my mother and father's room for protection and or intervention, if necessary. My mother woke up and tried to reassure me, "Steppy doors, don't worry. It's just a night noise." Night noise? What's a night noise? Sometimes houses make sounds. They do. Why? No one knows. But nothing will hurt you, darling. Please just go back to bed. I was unconvinced, but I went back to my room. I climbed into bed, pulled the covers over my head, and that's when I heard I. He called out my name. I said, "You can't hide from me. Come out. Come out from under those covers now." And I began to cry. I forced the covers back. I got out of bed, and shaking with fear, I started to walk toward the toy closet where I lived. I reached for the door, but then I heard his voice behind me. He told me he had moved from the closet to under my bed so he could be closer to me at night when I slept. But I found no comfort in that. In the end, I never knew if I was my fear or I was my salvation. I always wonder what happened to I, the Monster, such a constant companion to me when I was 3, 4, 5 years of age. It takes a lot of energy to sustain and create an entire monster. And if you believe what Albert Einstein says, that energy cannot be created nor destroyed, but only changes form, then I ask, what form did I change into? Where does our fear of the dark go? I have a theory. I think that over the course of human history, our fear of the dark has turned into science, art, and religion. Science to measure the darkness, art to show us its beauty, and religion to teach us that it's really light all the time. You just have to be able to believe in the light to see it. During the era of I, the Monster, I tried many things to ease my fear. I tried science in the form of a nightlight. I tried art in the form of focusing on the really good bedtime stories. And I even discovered prayer. I had never prayed in my life. I didn't even know what a prayer was. I was too young. But in preschool, we had a reader filled with drawings called What Good Children Do. And being good was very important to me because one of my chief concerns, besides the dark and I, the Monster, was the naughty and nice list that Santa Claus kept. During the last month, my teacher took away my cookie for opening my eyes during rest period. She made me stand in the hallway for using my desk as a set of drums. And at home, I even made my mother cry. I was afraid I was falling to the naughty side of the ledger. So, chapter 1 said, good children start the day, wash their face, brush their teeth, comb their hair. Throughout the day, they say please and thank you, and at night, they say their prayers. I asked my mother, what is a prayer? She said, steppy doors. That's when you talk to God. Well, I wasn't sure that was such a good idea. I mean, I was already scared of Santa. In the book, they had a picture of a very clean, blonde boy in pajamas kneeling by his bed with his hands folded, looking upward. I told my mother, I want to do that. And my mother said, all right. So after supper, I ran to the bathroom. I took my little book with me, and I combed my hair exactly the way the boy in the book had. He had a blonde swirl right here. And I tucked my pajama shirt into my pajama pants, got into my bedroom, knelt down, folded my hands, looked upward, and I said to my mother, what do you say when you talk to God? My mother thought about it, and she said, steppy doors, here's one you could try. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. What? This is what you're supposed to say to God to feel better about things? If I should die before I wake, come on. I would rather take my chances with I, the monster. Forget it. Well, that was the last time I said that prayer. I knew at this point I was going to die in my sleep and be on the naughty list. And it was under this dark cloud I experienced my first conspiracy, the probable collusion between my mother, my father, and Santa Claus. To be clear, we were Jewish. We should not have been celebrating Christmas. We did not have a Christmas tree. I mean, we did not have a chimney, which would have made any Santa contact problematic. But we lived in Oak Cliff. Oak Cliff was a suburb of Dallas, about 25 miles away from downtown. And it was home to exactly 3 Jewish families. And my mother and father were very sensitive to anti-Semitism. And they feared that other children would taunt us if we appeared to be different. But secretly, I think my parents were afraid of our being different, whether we were taunted or not. My mother and father decided not to give us presents on the 8 days of Hanukkah, but to go with the Santa scenario and give us our presents on Christmas morning. That way we wouldn't have to feel like outcasts on our first show and tell when we got back after winter break. However, it wasn't going to be that simple. It wasn't going to be as simple as celebrating Christmas in the good old-fashioned, non-religious, strictly commercial way with a tree, presents, and hot cocoa. No. My mother felt guilty that she was betraying her Jewish roots. So as a compromise, she said because we were Jewish, we could have no tree, and in its place, thanks to a thought process that baffles me to this day, we would get our presents under the dining room table. Like all children, we were up Christmas morning, up at dawn, racing into the dining room, scurrying between the chairs, looking under the table in the dark for packages that had our name on them, occasionally banging our head on the hard mahogany. One Christmas, I mustered up the courage to ask my mother the tough questions. Mom, we have no chimney. What is Santa going to do? She said, I put a note out for Santa to use the back door. Well, that disturbed me. It meant either we were leaving our house unlocked over the holiday, which seemed unsafe, or Santa had our key, which just seemed creepy. What is Santa going to do without a tree? I asked. My mother said, Santa is fine putting the presents under the dining room table, sweetheart. I said, I know he's fine with doing it, but why? Why does he do that? It's such a lot of work, and Christmas Eve is such a busy night for Santa. He's flying around, and now he has to stop and crawl around, move the chairs around. And my mother said, sweetheart, Santa does not mind doing extra work. He just doesn't want you to feel different from other children by not having your presents under something. I said, Mom, we're still different from other children. No other children get their presents under a dining room table. And the kids that have a Christmas tree, the presents aren't under the Christmas tree. The presents are around the Christmas tree. My mother thought about this for a while and then did what most people do when they rely on a conspiracy theory for their basis of reality. She passed the blame on up to a higher authority. Steppy doors. We wrote Santa about the chimney and the tree. He said leave the door unlocked and he would put the presents under the table. I don't know why he said that. That's what he said. You would have to talk to Santa about that. Deferring to Santa worked until I was six. I was in first grade. My doubts troubled me. I had no one to talk to about it until one afternoon after school. Right before the Christmas vacation, it was a sunny, cold December day, and I was headed over to Doherty's drugstore to read comic books before I walked home. And brief historical note, in the 1950s, children walked. I'm standing at Keese Boulevard, and I heard a classmate call me, "Hey, Stephen, where are you going?" And I turned around, and it was Dwayne. Dwayne. I didn't spend too much time with Dwayne. He didn't live in our neighborhood, so I rarely played with him, and I don't even remember speaking to him one-on-one except for this conversation I am about to relate to you. Dwayne was a very special kid. Even though he was in our first grade class, he had already turned seven. So I imagined he was a much wiser fellow than I. Dwayne was handsome. He was a good student, good athlete, never got into trouble. Teachers loved Dwayne. Dwayne was so popular that the principal of the school declared Dwayne the best citizen of the entire first grade, and that is six first grade classes. And this very day, Dwayne was wearing his blue ribbon pinned onto his sweater, and it was just flapping away in that cold December breeze. I was a little starstruck. As we walked, Dwayne asked me if I was looking forward to Christmas. I gave him my enthusiastic but highly conflicted, "Sure." Dwayne paused and looked off in the distance and turned back to me and said he still believed in Christmas. He was just not sure if he still believed in Santa. A fellow skeptic. I dare not tell him about the dining room table, though. Not yet, not yet. Too soon. I just swallowed hard and told him I was on the fence about Santa, too. Yeah, hard not to be, Dwayne said. Well, last year, Dwayne, I did hear a noise on the roof above my bed. It could have been a sleigh. Well, you have a chimney? Dwayne asked. No. Dwayne shook his head. Well, if you don't have a chimney, Santa's not going to land on your roof. Probably just squirrels? Yeah, probably. We stopped at the curb. Dwayne looked both ways for approaching traffic, and I blurted out, Dwayne, it's just, I really want to believe in Santa. And Dwayne turned to me and smiled, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, I know, Stephen, me too. But I think it's always easier to want to believe in something than it is to say it never was true. I was staggered by the profundity of the remark. Dwayne looked across the deserted playground for a moment, then back to me and said, don't get me wrong. I love Santa. but this will probably be the last year, I believe. I had that conversation over 50 years ago. I still remember it. And I thought I always remembered it because it was the only conversation I ever had about the Santa crisis. But now as I look back, no. I think it's memorable because it was my first crisis of belief. Over the decades, many crises of belief have come and gone. And a few years ago, I was going through another one, and I was headed back to Dallas at Christmas time, and not for anything as festive as opening the presents under the old mahogany table. I came back to honor my mother's yard site. That's the anniversary of her death. It's a very difficult time for our family and a very, very hard time for my father. But it was a good time for us all to come together. Time for me to spend time with my brother and sister. We would all tell stories. It was also a chance for me to sleep on my unsleepable bed. True. When I would go back to Dallas, I still slept on the same bed I had when I was a child. When that mattress salesman told Mom and Dad this bed would last a lifetime, they took him at his word. But a trip to Dallas also held a potential for archaeological discovery. My mother saved everything. She tucked the bits and pieces of our past in the most improbable places for safekeeping. And after she passed away, it became painfully clear that she did not leave a map. But sure enough, first night home, in a little broken dresser, next to my little broken nightstand in a bottom drawer underneath a pair of pajamas last worn in junior high school, I found an old manila envelope with my mother's handwriting on it saying, "For Stephen." And I opened it up, and inside was a copy of my elementary school newspaper, the Jefferson Davis Times. Yes, our school was named after the president of the Confederacy. I looked through the little paper, and there on the back page was a picture of our first grade class taken in front of the school. I studied it, and there was Dwayne. He was sitting on the ground next to me with his best citizen ribbon pinned to his shirt. It is the only picture I have of him, and I looked up and thanked my mother, wherever she may be, for the most wonderful Christmas present I ever got. And I took a pen, and I wrote Dwayne's words in the margin for fear that one day I might forget them. And it had an unexpected effect. I looked at the photo of all those six-year-old faces standing in front of Jefferson Davis Elementary, surrounded by the words, "It's always easier to want to believe in something than it is to say it never was true." And it became a grim school motto. Dwayne's proverb seemed to speak to false prophets and the way they enter our lives. His wisdom still shakes me to the core. But then again, he was 7. I put the paper down on my little broken bedside table, turned the lights out with the images of the photograph and Dwayne's words floating in my head. I've discovered that we often find things when we need them. And maybe all of the scraps of paper Mom had saved over the years weren't a product of her nuttiness at all, but were meant for me to unearth every now and then as some sort of amulet of protection. And I sat up in the dark, and I turned on the light, and I looked at the picture again, and I saw something new. I looked at Dwayne's words. "It's always easier to want to believe in something than it is to say it never was true." And before my eyes, the emphasis of the words changed, meaning turned on its head, and now the sentence read, "It's always easier to want to believe in something than it is to say it never was true." Now, Dwayne's proverb, instead of warning about self-deception, was talking about hope. He was saying the ability to believe is always present, always available. Belief is what gives us the power to see beyond the obvious. In the face of loss or disappointment, belief is the source of renewal and endurance. It is the foundation of the science of second chances. I was momentarily startled by a noise on the roof, a night noise. But now I recognize it as the central heat kicking in. Knowledge is the ultimate protection against the dark. But I had to smile when I realized my first thought was wondering how I, the monster, was doing. Some monsters never go away. I lay back down and closed my eyes. And in an instant, I was back on that street with Duane, about to cross over in that cold, cold afternoon before Christmas. He laughed and put his arm around my shoulder. We looked both ways for oncoming cars and then ran over to Doherty's drugstore. And just like that, I was in one of the good bedtime stories. And I closed my eyes and I had pleasant dreams. Thank you.